This is a National Arts Center podcast.
Welcome to NEC Dance with Kathy Levy. In this podcast, Kathy chats with Jean Grandmaître, Artistic Director of Alberta Ballet and choreographer, about the ballet Joni Mitchell's The Fiddle and the Drum that closes the NEC 2018-2019 dance season. This signature work was co-created with the iconic singer-songwriter.
Oh, Jean Grandmaître, welcome back to our Hexagon studio for another dance podcast.
It's good to be here.
It's so great to have you. You were last interviewed in French a number of years ago. Since then, of course, you've created so many works for Alberta Ballet, including this fantastic evening with the beloved Joni Mitchell, Fiddle and the Drum.
Yes.
I'm very excited. We're welcoming you back in May 2019. You're going to close out the NAC dance season of 18-19 with Joni Mitchell's The Fiddle and the Drum. This is, you talk about this as a contemporary ballet with an anti-war and environmental message that was created 10 years ago. You know, I read in the Joni Mitchell biography, Reckless Daughter, that this all started with you writing her a letter. What prompted you to do that? How did this all begin?
Well, it was amazing because I was very skeptic that Joni would be interested in creating a ballet. And what we did was we sent a letter to her agent at the time, who was in Vancouver, Sam Feldman Agency. And we were trying to celebrate her 40th anniversary that year. We wanted to do something very special. And I first started thinking about Beethoven symphonies, something in with the full orchestra and chorus. And then a friend had recommended Joni Mitchell.
Well, that's completely opposite to Beethoven in some ways, isn't it?
Couldn't it be more opposite?
Really, the other end of the spectrum.
And she was actually born in Alberta in the 4th MacLeod and grew up in Saskatoon.
That's funny because we often think of her as a Saskatonian, but yes, you're right, she was an Albertan.
I think at the age of 4. She moved to Saskatoon with her family. And so it was interesting, this idea that maybe Joni Mitchell would be interested in allowing us to create a ballet inspired by her music.
Did you know her music very well even then?
I knew all the hits,
okay,
all the great Joni Mitchell hits, but I didn't really know her entire anthology. And this is something I've learned to do when I work on these portrait ballets, is study the singer-songwriters inside out. And so what happened was I sent a letter with a few photos of her company and a project proposal. And she received the letter, and apparently she says no to almost every project proposal that came her way. She had been in retirement for almost 12 years when I sent the letter.
Yeah. Wow.
And so I thought it was a long shot, but lo and behold, I get an email from her agent saying she'd like to meet me in Los Angeles.
You wrote this beautiful letter. Please forgive my somewhat imperfect English, as I am a native of Quebec and I'm still brushing up on this new language.
Yes.
Who wouldn't be completely intrigued by that? It's just beautiful.
I wanted the letter to really come from me, not someone who would help me write it. And I think that actually was interesting because it touched her. And a few of the photos we sent with some ballerinas dancing in the Canadian prairies really touched her as well, because she's a prairie girl. And so I went to meet her in Los Angeles. It was in Beverly Hills in a restaurant that she had selected because she could smoke on the terrace at that time. And we met what I thought would be a two-hour dinner, and it turned out to be a six-hour meeting and an extraordinary encounter. And she was very interested in the proposal because for her, dance, her poetry, her words, her music all came together, and her visual art, because I was also proposing that she design the set design, that she create the visual environment for the dancers. And she agreed to do it all in our first dinner, which
amazing.
When I came home from that trip, I was really awestruck.
No kidding. Yeah. And then you worked together for a number of years before this project materialized.
Well, we programmed it for the following year. So we had 12 months to create the ballet. So it was a quick creation time for her. Because, you know, they work a long time on their albums, these singer-songwriters. But she was so excited about the project that... And at the time, it was a one-act ballet, not a full-length creation.
Right. I think when I saw it at the beginning, you did it on the other side of a Balanchine piece or something like that on the
yes,
program. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. That's right. It was a serenade.
Serenade, right.
That opened, and Joni loved that ballet. She was in awe of the dancers, and she fell in love with the dancers. You know, for her, this was one of the most joyous projects of her life. She later said on the, you know, in the media often saying how what a beautiful collaboration it was, because there was almost... I'd say 35 of us working on the ballet between the dancers, the designers, and the choreographer. It really made a nice big family.
But, you know, some people, when you're around someone that famous, not that you aren't also very famous in our dance world, Jean Gamet, but, you know, then, you know, there's a tendency to sort of do whatever they want.
Yes.
But when I had the good fortune to meet her briefly through you several years later, I had a real sense that, you know, you were her choreographer and she was... working alongside you. So how did you negotiate that kind of relationship with somebody who isn't used to having people have that push and pull?
I think she gave me a little bit more leeway because dance wasn't a vernacular that she'd mastered like music. But at the same time, after studying her and talking to a lot of musicians who've collaborated with her over the years, guitarists, drummers, sax players, you know, some of the most famous musicians of our time, they all said that collaborating with her was a great joy. The Mingus album, you know, all those jazz albums as well. And that she would say to them, you know, come in here like a bird singing and roll out like water here.
Wow.
And hover in the middle. And that's the kind of imagery she'd give me as well when we were talking about the ballet. And so she's an amazing collaborator. And I think many, many musicians will say that some of their best recordings were produced by Joni Mitchell.
How did you come about choosing some of the themes and the songs? I mean, as you say, you studied her whole catalog, which, you know, is enormous, of course, and so far-ranging. How did the two of you decide which songs to focus on and how to tie them together?
Well, that was a huge question because it encompasses everything in the sense that now I've worked with six singer-songwriters.
This was the first, right?
Joni opened the doors.
Ballet.
And because she's so respected in the music industry, she helped open a lot of doors. Elton John wanted one. And then we approached Katie Lang, Sarah McLachlan, Tragically Hip, Gordon Lightfoot. You know, I've been blessed. But Joni taught me everything. She taught me how to approach this type of creation because she... Basically, before I met her, I'd worked 6 months on a script. And then when I threw her the idea, she didn't like it. You know, it was based on her life, her portrait of her life, and she didn't want that. And she said to me at the time, look at what's happening to the planet and look at what's happening. There was a war in Iraq that was very, very violent. And so the wars were ongoing and the depletion of our ecology and our environment, it was ongoing. And that's what really mattered to her. And that's what she wanted the ballet to be about. And, you know, bless her, she didn't hang up her beads like so many did from the 60s. She's still fighting for causes that mean a lot to her and her music, and she did that through the 80s and 90s. So she had a different idea of where the ballet should go. And we ended up at her house, and she showed me a lot of her artwork and her recent artwork, which is featured now in the ballet. It was all about war, environmental collapse. And so this is 2006, you have to remember. And everything that she sings about in the ballet, everything that she warned us about now is happening. So 10 years later, this ballet will be very chilling, I think, in a way. And she was about the environment, you know, way before even Greenpeace. When you look at when she wrote Big Yellow Taxi, that was David Suzuki was surprised to hear when we met him how early in the game she was,
amazing,
you know, for the environment. And, And so it was interesting because this impetus, she had this passion for these themes, it's inspired her to now want to create the set design and the soundtrack. And so she chose with me the songs, but we chose songs together that related to these themes of war, the environment, neglect. And so the theme brought us to the songs. She wrote four new songs for the ballet, which we premiered at the time, which was Beyond Belief, on top of designing the sets.
And that's unbelievable because, again, as you said at the beginning, she's virtually retired from the music world.
Yes. And, you know, I didn't know that she was writing a new album, actually. It was a big secret. And she'd been recording with just a few musicians. And some of those songs were premiered in the ballet before her album Shine was released, which was her last album of composed new work.
Right.
So it was fantastic that she wanted to get involved, and we ended up spending 2.5 years together creating this ballet.
So you made the first act of it in 2008-09 season.
Yes.
And then, is that correct?
The first act was 2006-07.
2006-07, right.
And 2007-08 was when we added 5 new songs and made it a full-length ballet with an intermission in the middle.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she's not only invested, she continues to be invested. How did your relationship change over that time?
Oh, it was interesting.
I know you're still friends today, so.
Oh, we're very close. Yeah. And we found a very close friendship in this process, and from the very beginning, a lot of trust. She had a lot of ideas, all of them brilliant. She is a genius, and, you know, one of the rare geniuses I've met in my life. And as she grows older now, and she's celebrating her 75th birthday this year, there's a lot of galas happening and homages and tributes across North America and Europe. I just feel that as I grow older, she's led me on so many different artistic paths. And she's taught me to stay very, very close to my ideas and have integrity that way, you know. And
when you say different artistic paths, can you give me an example of what that is?
Well, she opened my mind to all kinds of new music. You know, in ballet, we tend to gravitate towards orchestral music. And her music is so rich in harmonically, rhythmically, in every way. And the lyrics are so brilliant. Mm-hmm. And she's recorded masterpieces in every genre. I always call her the Stanley Kubrick of music because Kubrick made a masterpiece in every genre, mm-hmm. and she did as well, mm-hmm. blues, jazz. Mm-hmm. Yes. And you know what's interesting is that what I've learned the most from her is to have courage in what you want to say and how you're going to say it. And once you're done, to pat yourself on the back a little bit, mm-hmm. you know, to be proud of something you've done. And in that way, she's the most inspiring person I've ever met.
That's amazing. And did she, like, I know this is going to sound a bit silly, but did she ever say, no, Jean, you should go left instead of going right? Like, did she want to also implicate herself in the movement and the choreography?
She did. And when she did, she was right.
Really?
Yeah. There was moments where she said, look, I'm singing about misery here. I'm singing the word misery. And the dancers are stretching away from their center. They should be compressing.
Wow.
And, yes, and at the other point, she maybe had, when she saw the whole ballet the first time, she maybe had 8 notes. There wasn't that many. All of them very pertinent. At one point, she said, just freeze the dancers here because I'm singing about a red light and let them start a little later. And that moment in the ballet when they freeze is one of the strongest moments that everyone tells me. So she really had a good eye because she's a painter. And being a painter makes her a visual artist. And she even says that when she composes music, it's like painting, brush strokes, adding layers. And so in that way, she really had an extraordinary eye to watch dance. And then she edited the film of the ballet. And she edited that film for 6 months, down to the hundredth of a second. And her assistant editor said she was just extraordinary to work
wow.
with. So she created a visual painting of the ballet, if you have a chance to see the film.
As a separate documentary.
Yes.
But can you explain to people what's going on visually in the ballet? I know how strong and beautiful your choreography is. What were the visual components that she contributed to make that ballet?
Well, we have three ways. First, she had a very strong sense of the color palette the ballet should be in. She had been taking photographs of her television for over a year with digital cameras because her television had broken and the screen was pulsating in colors of green, champagne yellows, jades. But she was watching all these war images from Iraq in this aesthetic, you know, and it really struck her. So she started taking photos of her television. And then she started developing triptychs. So one was a Bubbs B. Berkeley film photo. Another one was a war in Iraq, people being imprisoned. And so it was all these images that were so impactful. And through that filter of that green jade filter, they became almost mythical images. And so from these photos, which were projected in the ballet as a background, so there's a circular screen above the dancers. She called it God's Eye. And on that screen appears almost 80 different artworks, which she edited to the beat of the music, to the pluck of a guitar string. And so she worked down that the rhythm of that video down to the greatest detail. And then the characters that appear on that screen are green, yellow, and we decided we were going to body paint the dancers as if though they walked right out of her paintings onto the stage, and they bring to life her characters and her stories and her lyrics.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
How was it for the dancers to work with her? Was it difficult for them to embrace this approach, to work in this way with a composer of such stature?
They loved it. They didn't meet her till the very end. You know, I met her a lot through the creative process, but they did meet her at the very end. And before that, they just loved her music. And often when dancers dance to vocal music, it could be Latin, the Mozart Requiem. You know, but these words, when you're singing to songs written in English, you understand the words and the lyrics. It actually inspires them deeply as they're performing. They've said that often. And then she came to the studios the week before we opened, watched rehearsals. That's when she gave me some of her notes and fell in love with the dancers. It was a real beautiful moment to see her joy. And it was, I think, one of the happiest moments for her in a long time. And also these songs were songs that meant a lot to her. Songs about the environment and war, and they were songs from the 80s and the 90s, not the decades for which she's most famous for, but a prolific period in her life.
I looked again at all the lyrics for Fiddle and the Drum in, before I was going to be talking to you, and like the National Arts Center, it's celebrating its 50th anniversary this year in 2019. So how are those lyrics still relevant today?
Well, as I was saying earlier, they talk about abandoned love, which we see so much now in politics, the mood of fear and intolerance and lack of compassion. So they sing of love, they sing of decency, they sing of how to care for the world. And then they warn us of what will happen, the lakes that will dry up, climate change. And she has such a powerful way of singing about, because she's a great poet. So it hits you in the gut, these difficult words, and at the same time, the melodies are so sublime that I think it increases the power of the lyrics, because you can see what she wanted to do with this ballet was to be able to show what humanity can do at its most beautiful and at its worst. And that's the genius, I think, of Joni Mitchell's songs, is in many of her lyrics, you will have that contrast in the very same song. And you know, as she said once, a song without that moment of clarity is just complaining. And so for her, the ballet also had moments of clarity and hope. So there's a lot of hope that if humanity can have compassion for the planet and for each other, we can find our way out of this mess.
So besides the sort of anniversary markings of Fiddle on the Drum and 10 years, what's it like to revisit something like that after all this time? What's it like for you to go back and remount this work for your home season and for the NAC?
Well, we're hoping Joni will join us, possibly here in Ottawa or in Alberta. She really wants
Ottawa,
to join
we
us.
We vote for Ottawa. That
yes,
would be great.
I would love it, because she's had a lot of love-ins now in the U.S. for her 75th birthday, and we could give her a big hug here at the National Arts Center.
Yeah, we will talk about that in a second. Yeah. But you're going back, you're kind of dusting off something. You've as you mentioned before, have created all these other ballets, some pop ballets, some contemporary ballets. Some classical, you go back to something from 10 years ago. So on the one hand, you're listening to those lyrics and recognizing, as you said, the resonance of those truths in the world today, and in some cases even more so, perhaps, given what we're facing in the world today. But the actual steps and the dancers and...
We were going to start in January, remounting the ballet, and I can't wait to be back in the room with that music. And there's only two dancers from the original cast that are left. So for all the dancers, it's a new ballet. There's two ways I'm looking at it. I can't wait to get back in the studio with her voice and her music and those beautiful dancers and bring it back to life for her, knowing that she wants to come and see it. I can't wait also to revisit all the beautiful lighting and how this wonderful creation was made. It's going to have so many memories for us. And then I'm thinking about the content of the ballet and the dire warnings and the plea for love and compassion that she does probably better than most singer-songwriters on the planet. And how it's actually, when I re-looked at the ballet just recently to get ready to restage it, it gave me a bit of a chill, you know, I have to say, because of, at the time, I even thought, you know, what she was saying would happen 100 years from now. But it's happening now, the fires in California. She was actually evacuated from her own house during one of those fires. Oh. It filled up with smoke, and in less than a half hour, and they got her out just in time, and then the house didn't burn down. But you
miraculously.
Know, she, miraculously. And she, they brought her back a week later, and she'd been singing and writing about this, you know, 30 years ago. Nobody really listened, and we thought it would happen two generations from now, and it isn't. So I think the ballet is probably one of the most relevant ballets I've ever created that way because of Joni That's Mitchell.
Amazing. That's amazing. It's, you know, and you mentioned, of course, we're still celebrating her, and thankfully she's still with us. And, you know, we do hope that she is part of this whole celebration with the company and with these performances. But let's just talk a little bit about what that led you to, because I think the next project that you did was with Elton John,
yes.
Right? Who, you know, in, is also an iconic songwriter and music maker, but a very different process for you.
It, yes.
We've had the opportunity of showing that piece, and many other of your portrait ballets haven't gotten here yet.
Yes.
Still to come. But, you know, what is it about these, you've become known now for doing these incredibly interesting signature ballets with these iconic pop composers.
Well, it was interesting because it wasn't supposed to happen. As I was saying earlier, Joni was for our 40th anniversary, wanted something special. And the BBC came, the CBC did a whole documentary about it. We were on the front page of the New York Times Arts and Leisure section. It was unbelievable what Alberta Ballet received as media attention. There was paparazzi at the door. I'd never seen that for a ballet. And then artistically, it was such a rich, profound adventure that we had together that we knew that developing more ideas brings in a new audience as well, which is the biggest challenge we all have now, is how do you find portals? And this became a portal we knew immediately, not just for younger, but all demographics. Joni Mitchell fans reach all demographics. And so we continued, and what we were thinking about more Canadian singer-songwriters, but I got a call one Friday afternoon, and it was from Elton John's right-hand man in my office. I picked up the phone and I thought it was a joke, but no, Elton wanted to meet us backstage. He was touring through Calgary and invited 10 dancers, gave us front row seats, and we met him before the show in his dressing room. And he was, he's a huge fan of Joni Mitchell. I mean, it's, for him, she's a goddess. And so he wanted a DVD of the ballet. He wanted to know all about what she did and how she collaborated. And so we gave him a DVD of the ballet, and he went home. And 3 months later, we sent him an email saying, would he enjoy us creating a ballet to his music? And I got an answer within 5 minutes. I thought it would take months, and I had an answer. In 5 minutes, come and meet Mr. Elton John in Las Vegas. He's performing, and we met, and met a few times before we premiered the ballet to talk about the creation. And then he took me on a whole different path. You know, it was going to be about his life, about all the causes for which he raises money, whether it's alcoholism, addiction, repression, all the what he suffered from in his own life. Now he's raising money for these causes, hundreds of millions of dollars. So he wanted the ballet to tackle actually his own life, to inspire people to not be afraid to tackle these issues.
A very different will, if you may, than Joni Mitchell.
Yes.
And I noticed the other day that there's a movie that's going to come out next summer,
yes,
called Rocket Man, which all about...
It looks fantastic.
Yeah, it does.
Same director as Billy Elliot.
Aha, uh-huh, that's right.
Yes.
The trailer looks great.
But you know, Joni was a neoclassical ballet and some contemporary work in there as well. Elton became more of a cabaret because Elton's music led to that aesthetic naturally. So each singer-songwriter brought us into a completely different aesthetic. So no two portrait ballets really look alike in vocabulary or in how we created the ballet aesthetically.
Do you have plans to revisit some of them in the way that you're revisiting Joni Mitchell's Fiddle on the Drum?
Oh, yes, I hope so, you know. And I think some of them I'd like to re-choreograph sections as well. You know, choreographers, we love revisiting work. With Joni, I'm going to try to change it as little as I can to leave it exactly as she last saw it, so that when she sits in the theater, she's going to say, I remember every moment.
Yeah, your last one that I got a chance to see was Our Canada with Gordon Lightfoot, which of course came out in 2017.
Yes.
But since then, you've done this fantastic ballet featuring the music of the Tragically Hip.
Yes.
Sort of on the heels of us all losing Gord Downie, and that was a big Canadian experience called All of Us.
Huge.
That I guess we'll get to see at some point down the road, summer or fall of 19. So that's great.
Yeah.
Who's going to be next?
Well, you know, I'm working on three of them because for every singer we manage to convince, there's a few who are not convinced along the way.
Of course. That's a reality check. That's really interesting to share that.
Oh, yeah. It's not as easy as people think. You have to have a way to connect with the musicians directly. If it just goes to the agent, it doesn't always get to the musicians. And that's why I noticed how lucky we were with Sam Feldman and Joni Mitchell, because he sent her the package and it was the first one out the gate. But because of the success we've had, it's been getting easier and easier now to encourage musicians. So now I'm working on David Bowie, and we're very close, but we're not confirmed yet.
Okay.
But we have a whole project designed, and we've been talking with them for almost 2 months now about it. So it's interesting to see how big it can be and also how intimate. For me, there's some singers like Katie Lang, who was from Alberta. That really hit home when we premiered that ballet in Alberta, but she was an extraordinary collaborator as well. I've been lucky to work with all these singer-songwriters. They're brilliant. They've lasted the decades. They're not just the flavor of the month singer-songwriters.
That's one of the other things I noticed. You know, like a Sarah McLachlan song comes on the radio from her peak period or even not.
Yes.
And people still respond to it. Same thing, of course, KD, like, you know, the popularity. I mean, she was at the National Arts Centre recently and the popularity is still enormous.
They're in the pantheon now.
They really are, but they still are out there performing, which is quite wonderful.
Well, they always say they're going to retire, but then they don't. It's like Cher. They can't. They love singing, you know, it's in their blood. One thing I've realized from working with so many singer-songwriters and getting to meet them is that most singer-songwriters vibrate a love and a compassion in their heart, and that's why they make music. I think they're always making music somehow in their subconscious, and they're just extraordinary beings. Of Sarah McLachlan, the most giving, generous person I've met, and wanting to help us in every way for the ballet to be successful. So it's been a joy and a great inspiring. Some people might say, oh, you're better off with Shostakovich and Stravinsky.
Well, and listen, as a choreographer, you rise to all kinds of these occasions. You know, we were fortunate to work with you also in 2017 on Encounters, when you did a new contemporary ballet for us with a new composition, a new score by Andrew Staniland. And that's, that was a highlight of our year. And I think it's important also that different types of composers and musicians keep pushing you as well. Some who are well-known in the pop icon.
But for me, Joni Mitchell is as important to Canadian culture as Glenn Gould.
Absolutely.
You know, and they've played an important part in showing Canadian heart aspirations and dreams to the rest of the world.
How does Joni feel about those early songs?
Oh, she has mixed feelings about all of them.
Like Big Yellow Taxi, for example, which got played every single day during her 75th birthday celebrations.
Oh, yes. Oh, did it?
Yeah,
oh,
a lot. It was a featured song that got,
that's fantastic.
Because people were making the same point, is that here we are, how many decades later, and this is a very important song for us to be listening to.
I think as I went to visit Joni 2 weeks ago and saw the most peaceful person, happy and joyous, and she was nervous about this big gala at the L.A. Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. The movie stars and music stars, everybody was there for her. I don't think I've ever seen a Canadian get an homage like that. And the night before, I saw her and I said, how do you feel about tomorrow and the big gala? And she said, I'm very nervous. I'm a bit overwhelmed. And I said, think about it as two giant arms coming to give you a giant hug of love, you know. And that's how she smiled all night, and she took it in that way. And in that,
that's beautiful.
She's become wiser with time. She was, you know, quite a feisty woman because she was in the music industry when no women were. There was maybe four or five of them. Mm-hmm. And the record industry was tough on her, and the media on rock stars wasn't always the nicest. So she had a lot of reasons to be hiding away, I think, for an artist of her stature.
I was listening a couple of weeks ago to Miles of Isles, which is, of course, the live recording. And she says this wonderful thing to the crowd in that. And she says, you know, nobody ever asked Van Gogh to paint A Starry Night again, but it's the kind of thing people always ask pop musicians to play that song again. And, you know, that recording was from when she was just a young woman. But she says it with a certain kind of tenacity and a message to the audience, like, respect the artists, man. Like, don't push us to just be, you know, star making machinery. Like, it's exactly. Just, you know, don't push us to just be commodities.
Like her song also, For the Roses. Mm-hmm. I heard the applause. It was like the wind in the arbutus tree.
Yes.
And there's something about her words that capture the ephemeralness and the superficiality of stardom. Music industry for her was like the rat on the spinning wheel, and she didn't want to be part of that business. She wanted a true musical adventure. Every album she experimented, and you know, masterpieces in the blues, jazz, rock, folk, of course.
Okay, but not to put too much on the stardom. Tell us how that night was. How was the album party?
I was starstruck.
I'm sure you were. We
it
saw
was
all
beautiful
kinds of great
to see that, you know, people from greatest actors and actresses to singer-songwriters came to honor her. She looked like Georgie O'Keefe out there in the theater. You know, she was the queen of them all. And she just was very humbled about it as well, very touched by all the singers who had to perform her songs. Poor singers, they're so hard, her songs, and they did a great job. But you realize just how brilliant she was when other singers interpret her songs. And so in that way, it was such a fabulous night. And to see that a Canadian artist is so beloved across all other art forms, not just in the music industry. And they gave her a beautiful Indigenous homage where they gave her the name of, I think, a Sparkling White Bear Woman. And that's the second highest honor you can receive from the Indigenous communities of Canada. So there was a very Canadian touch to the whole evening and the gala and the dinner afterwards. And so that was really special, that the whole decor on stage and in the dining area was inspired by Canadiana, and it was beautifully done.
I love that the Music Center did that and was sensitive to that. It's quite wonderful.
Oh,
that
they
had that
they
in
worked
mind.
Hard on that. Even the food, everything. And they videoed Joni's property in BC, where she spends half the year. Well, she hasn't been there in many years now since she's been sick, and she really misses it. That's where she wrote almost all her songs. And so there, she has this view over off the Sunshine Coast in BC, and they went and filmed it. And then they projected it during the entire dinner. So she had a live video feed of her property in BC. She could see the birds and the water moving.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yes, she was so touched.
It's really, really spectacular.
They did a very nice job.
Well, we're thrilled that you're bringing this ballet to us in May. Now, you mentioned, before I let you go, you mentioned that there was a film of Joni Mitchell's The Fiddle and the Drum. Is
yes.
that a film that people can see and download?
You can order it online for sure.
Okay.
It's online, and it's also now on DVD, on Blu-ray, I think it actually was, because it's gone cult. You know, everything she does goes cult.
Yes.
And I get emails from friends in Argentina and England. They saw it. And
maybe you'll have to bring a bunch of copies along with the soundtrack, which I understand is also published as a separate soundtrack, is it not?
Yes, it's also published. And she wanted the soundtrack to be, how do you say?
Released.
Released, yes.
Yeah.
No, altogether, I mean, what a legacy for Alberta Ballet. It's probably our most famous creation ever, and it's opened doors across Europe and the North American markets for us. And
so what do you want to say to the people of Ottawa, close to where you were born? Your parents are just up the road in Wakefield. What do you want to say to the people of Ottawa about Joni Mitchell's Fiddle and the Drum?
Well, if you love her music and her songs, you will be pleased. If you want to sit in the theater with the lights out and feel like you're close to Joni again and what she sings about and what her world is all about, then this is a show to see for sure.
Thank you so much for your time, Jean-Claude Met. I'm so excited to welcome you back here in May, and I'm so excited to have Joni Mitchell's Fiddle and the Drum on our season this year.
We're thrilled to perform it in this prestigious theater.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all for this NEC Dance podcast. Send us your comments and questions by email at necpodcasts@gmail.com. And don't forget, you can subscribe to NEC Podcasts at necpodcasts.ca. You can also find us as a free subscription in the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store. Until next time, goodbye from Canada's National Arts Centre. We'll be right back.
This has been a National Arts Center podcast produced in Ottawa by NAC New Media. Send us your comments and questions. Email us at nacpodcasts@gmail.com. Visit the podcast section of the iTunes store, where you can rate and comment on this podcast. We love to hear from you. Remember, you can find more great NAC podcasts at nacpodcast.ca or search on National Arts Center on iTunes and subscribe for free. Until next time, goodbye from Canada's National Arts Center.